The Great Second Advent Movement by J. N. Loughborough, Chapter 24. Other Predictions Fulfilled. Consider now from this day and upward, from the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine, and the fig tree, and the pomegranate, and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you. Haggai 2, verses 18 and 19. The sure and steady advancement of the third angel's message from its first inception may well be compared with the prosperity that attended Zerubbabel from the day he laid the foundation stone of the temple. A forbidding prospect. When the Jewish people, with empty purse and granaries, were called to build the Lord's temple, it looked to all human appearance as a forbidding prospect. When by faith they obeyed the call and took hold of the work willingly, God's prospering hand was manifest to them. As we trace the experiences in the rise of this third message, we discern the guiding hand with those who chose his way. Although affliction be their lot, still God's care for his people and his work is always made clear to those who trust in him. Testimony delineating character. On November 24, 1862, two meetings were held at the same hour in the house of William Wilson of Greenville, Michigan, for the purpose of organizing two churches for those who had accepted the Sabbath truth in that vicinity. The meeting of the Greenville Church was conducted by Elder White and his wife in one room, while Elder Byington and myself had charge of a meeting in another room for the West Plains Church. While we were engaged in the preliminary work in one room, we could hear the voice of Mrs. White as she bore her testimony in the other room. We were meeting with some difficulties in our work when, just at the opportune time, Mrs. White opened the door and said, "Brother Loughborough, I see by looking over this company that I have testimonies for some of the persons present. When you are ready, I will come in and speak." That being just the time we needed help, she came in. Aside from Elder Byington and myself, she knew the names of only three persons in the room. The others were strangers, whom she had never seen, only as they had been presented to her in vision. Mr. Pratt's life described. As she arose to speak, she said, quote, "You will have to excuse me in relating what I have to say if I describe your persons, as I do not know your names. As I see your countenances, there comes before me what the Lord has been pleased to show me concerning you. That man in the corner with one eye," someone spoke, saying, "his name is Pratt, makes high professions and great pretensions to religion, but he has never yet been converted. Do not take him into the church in his present condition, for he is not a Christian. He spends much of his time idling about the shops and stores, arguing the theory of the truth, while his wife at home has to cut the firewood, look after the garden, etc. He makes promises in his bargains that he does not fulfill. His neighbors have no confidence in his profession of religion. It would be better for the cause of religion, for him, in his present condition, to say nothing about it." Brother Barr made glad. She continued, saying, quote, "This aged brother," as she pointed to him, someone said Brother Barr, "was shown me in direct contrast with the other man. He is very exemplary in his life, careful to keep all of his promises, and provides well for his family. He hardly ventures to speak of the truth to his neighbors for fear he will mar the work and do harm. He does not see how the Lord can be so merciful as to forgive his sins, and thinks himself unfit even to belong to the church," close quote. She then said to him, quote, "Brother Barr, the Lord bade me to say to you that you have confessed all the sins you knew of, and that he forgave your sins long ago, if you would only believe it," close quote. The look of sadness on the brother's countenance quickly fled. He looked up with a smile and said in his simplicity, "Has he?" "Yes," responded Mrs. White, "and I was told to say to you, come along and unite with the church, and as you have opportunity, speak a word in favor of the truth. It will have a good effect, as your neighbors have confidence in you." He responded, "I will." Then she said, "If Mr. Pratt could, for a time, take a position similar to that which Brother Barr has been occupying, it would do him good." Thus was one cause of our difficulty in organizing removed. Before her testimony was born, we could not get Mr. Barr to consent to unite with the church, while on the other hand, we found about everyone was opposed to receiving Mr. Pratt. Still, no one felt free to tell why he opposed. A family jealousy healed. She next addressed a man, having a sandy complexion, who sat on one side of the room, and then pointed to a thin-featured woman on the extreme opposite side, addressing them as husband and wife. She delineated some things that transpired in their former lives before either of them had made any profession of the truth. She said these things had been magnified by Satan before the mind of the woman, until she was driven to insanity. Quote, "I saw," said Mrs. White, "that this woman had been 1 year in the insane asylum, but since recovering her reason, she has permitted these same jealous feelings to trouble her mind, greatly to the grief of her husband, who has done everything in his power to show his wife that he was true to her, and that she had no reason to hold him off in the manner she does." Close quote. In a moment, the wife rushed across the room and on her knees begged her husband to forgive her. The individuals were almost strangers in that part of the country, and their former history was unknown. Those best acquainted with them, however, were aware that an estrangement existed between them, but the cause they knew not. Similar to Elisha and Haziel. After Mrs. White had borne her testimony, the work of organizing the church was soon completed. Mr. Barr came heartily into the organization while Mr. Pratt was left out. The moment the meeting closed, the latter said with considerable vehemence, quote, "I tell you what, there's no use trying to go with this people and act the hypocrite. You can't do it." Close quote. The delineation of character, as in the above instance, forcibly reminds us of a similar case recorded in the days of Elisha the prophet, 2 Kings 8, verses 7 through 15. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, had sent his servant Haziel to Elisha to inquire whether he should recover of his sickness. Elisha had had a view of Haziel's case, and as the man came before him, and he looked on his countenance, all came vividly to his mind. Elder White stricken with paralysis. On Wednesday, August 16, 1865, Elder White, as a result of excessive labor and loss of sleep, had a stroke of paralysis. As health institutions among our people had not yet been established, he was taken to Dansville, New York, to a health institution called Our Home on the Hillside. His wife and the writer were with him there from September 14 to December 7. As he received but little relief from the treatments given in the institution, we went to the hospital home of Bradley Lampson, Lakeview, Rochester, New York, where we remained about 3 weeks. Here we were glad to meet Elder Jay and Andrews, who had just returned to that city after having spent several months in Maine. Prayer for Elder White. The families of Elder Andrews and Mr. Horton joined with us every afternoon in a praying season with and for Elder White. This continued until December 25. While the outside world was full of gaiety and feasting on that Christmas day, it was observed by the Rochester Church as a day of fasting and prayer for Elder White. We had meetings in both the forenoon and afternoon at the house of Elder Andrews, New Main Street. And in the evening, those who had been previously praying with Elder White met with him again at the house of Mr. Lamson. The vision given Christmas night. The meeting that evening was a powerful one. Elder White was greatly blessed, and Mrs. White was given a wonderful vision in which many things were shown her. Among these were instructions to Elder White how to proceed that he might carry out his faith in God, who had so evidently reached down his hand to work for him that he might regain his health. Satan's attack predicted. To those who had been praying for Elder White, Mrs. White said, quote, "Satan's purpose was to destroy my husband and bring him down to the grave. Through these earnest prayers, his power has been broken. I have been shown that Satan is angry with this company, who have continued for 3 weeks praying earnestly in behalf of this servant of God, and he is now determined to make a powerful attack upon them. I was told to say to you, live very near to God, that you may be prepared for what may come upon you." Close quote. J.T. Orton's Premonitions. On the first day of January, 1866, Elder White and his family started by train for Battle Creek, Michigan. I remained in western New York the rest of the winter. From the very evening that the vision was given, Mr. J.T. Orton was impressed that his life was in danger, and yet he knew not from what source. This impression he expressed to several. On Sunday evening, March 4, he returned to Rochester from Parma, where he had been attending a 2 days meeting in company with Mr. E.B. Sanders, now in 1905 residing in San Jose, California, whom he requested to keep on the lightest street as they walked through the city. For, he said, "I feel all the while as though someone is going to try to kill me." And yet, he did not seem to have any idea who it was that wanted to take his life. I returned to Rochester from Parma, March 7, and stopped with Mr. Lamson, son-in-law of Mr. Orton. On the 8th, he and Mrs. Orton visited with us, when we made arrangements to go the next morning by train to Lancaster, Erie County, where I was to perform the marriage ceremony for his only son. The day was spent pleasantly by us, yet it was a solemn day. Murder of J.T. Orton. They left Mr. Lamson's at 5 p.m., and at 7:30 p.m., a messenger came informing us of a brutal attack that had been made on Mr. Orton by some unknown person in his own barn while caring for his horses. We hastened to the place and found that he had been cruelly beaten over the head with an iron-bound cart stake, and was unconscious. He died at 12:35 that night. To this day, it is unknown who committed the cruel deed. It certainly was not done for money, as his pocket was untouched, as was also his purse, which contained $45. This was a heavy shock to Mrs. Horton, from the effects of which she never recovered. Her bodily health rapidly failed, and she did not long survive her husband. Prediction made that Christmas fulfilled. In a few months from that memorable Christmas evening, 6 of the 9 who engaged in that 3 weeks of prayer were in their graves. And thus was another prediction most strikingly fulfilled. Relief to the despairing. In the early morning of December 12, 1866, Elias Stiles of North Liberty, Indiana, came to my home, requesting me to go with him to that place to administer relief, if possible, to James Harvey, who was in despair, and feeling that there was no hope in his case. Knowing that Mrs. White had had a very extensive view in the last vision given, and that many cases were shown to her prophetically, I said to him, "It may be that Sister White has seen something about his case, and if so, and if she will write it out, it will be more forcible than anything I could say to him. We at once called upon her, and without a word being spoken to her of Mr. Harvey's condition, I asked, "Sister White, have you any light in any of the visions given you concerning the case of Brother James Harvey?" "Yes," she said, "I have, and I have felt for a few days as though I ought to write it out and send it to him." She then began to tell us what she had seen. I said, "I'm going to see him in the morning, and if you'll write it out what has been shown to you, I will take it to him." With this understanding, we left her, and in the evening we called again. She had completed the writing and favored us by reading it out loud. Testimony for James Harvey in despair. The testimony stated clearly that Mr. Harvey would be brought into a feeble condition of health, and that Satan would seek to crowd him into despair and try to make him think that there was no mercy for him and no hope in his case, but she saw he had done all in his power to rectify the mistakes of his past life, and that God had forgiven him, and furthermore, when he should be tempted to destroy himself, she was shown that angels of God were hovering around him and pointing him to hope in God in heaven. There were many like words of comfort and encouragement in the testimony. With this document in my possession, we went the next morning to North Liberty. On the way, Mr. Stiles told me that Mr. Harvey wanted to see me, but he said that I would have no word of hope for him, and that when I should meet him, I would agree with him that his case was hopeless, and that he was a lost man, and then, like Eli of old, when he was told that the ark of God was taken, he should fall over backward and die. We arrived at Mr. Harvey's about 3 p.m. When I met him, I said, "Brother Harvey, how are you?" In a most lamentable strain, he replied, "Lost, lost, lost!" "No, you are not lost. There is hope in your case," said I. When he saw that I thus answered him, he said in a modulated tone, "I have thought for 3 weeks that there was no hope for me, and that I was lost. And today, as I was coming into town from the farm and passing over the bridge at the mill pond, something seemed to say to me, 'You are lost. There is no hope for you. Jump into the mill pond and drown yourself.' I thought to do such a thing would bring reproach on the cause of Christ, and so I was restrained from destroying myself. Deliverance came quickly." "Well, Brother Harvey, you are not lost," I said. "I have a testimony here direct from heaven saying that you are not lost." He replied, "Then I will hear it." I then read the testimony to him after first stating that not one word had been placed in my hands. As I completed the reading, his face lightened up with a smile as he said, "Then there is hope in my case. I do believe in the Lord." Following the reading, we had a praying season from which he arose a changed and happy man. He told us that that writing described the workings of his mind for the last 3 weeks more accurately than he could possibly have done it. Thus the love of God was shown in lifting this brother by this means out of despair. Field of labor enlarged. Up to the year 1868, the Seventh-day Adventist field of labor had been confined to the United States and to that portion of it north of the southern boundary of Missouri and east of the Missouri River. At a meeting to consider the fields and the distribution of labor during a session of the General Conference, which was held in Battle Creek, Michigan, May 28, it was decided to send 2 laborers and a 60-foot tent to California. Elder D.T. Bardot and the writer arrived in San Francisco July 18 of that year. Opening of the California Mission. One thing I wish to notice in connection with the opening of the California Mission, which well illustrates the practical utility of the gift of prophecy, Paul, in speaking of spiritual gifts, including the gift of prophecy, says they are for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Ephesians 4, verse 12. Surely the most feasible way to perfect saints is to point out to them their errors, so that they may put them away and be washed from their sins in the precious blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. To this end, aid through the gift of prophecy and the work of the ministry has all the way along been manifested in connection with the cause of present truth, pointing out to the servants of the Lord the defects in their manner of labor, and how by a different mode they could be more efficient in the conversion of souls. Testimony on how to labor in California. Shortly after our arrival in California, we received a letter from Mrs. White, in which she related a vision given her in Battle Creek on Friday evening of June 12, a day that we had spent at Lancaster, New York, before starting for California. She had never been in California and had no personal knowledge of the habits of the people. In fact, at that time, she had never been west of the Missouri River. Any knowledge she possessed concerning things there were derived from what the Lord was pleased to reveal to her. In the instruction in her letter, she delineated the liberal ways of the people of California and what would be the effect of labor among them on a close, penny-wise plan. In preaching to the people of California, they must be approached in something of the liberal spirit in which they work, and yet not in the spendthrift manner. The predicted success game. As I now look back over the last 37 years since the work was first started in California, and take in the situation then, with the condition of the people and the manner in which we would have conducted our work but for the testimony received, and as I witness the results of following the instruction given, I can say that our cause advanced more in 3 months than it would have done in 1 year had we not been helped in the work of the ministry by the instruction received through the gift of prophecy. Up to the spring of 1871, as the result of the efforts in Sonoma County, 5 churches of Sabbath keepers had been raised up. The first tent meeting in San Francisco. In June the same year, we erected our tent for the first time in San Francisco. As Elder Bordeaux had returned to the East, another laborer from Michigan was sent to take his place. He arrived on June 17 and at once united with me in labor in the city. After a few weeks' effort in the tent, we continued our meetings to December 1, 1871 in hired halls. As the result of this labor, over 50 accepted the message in San Francisco. Internal trials in California. Until this date, our trials in California had been more from outside opposition, but now arose an unlooked-for test of faith for our people of a different character. An associate laborer persisted in a course of action which I was confident would subject himself and the cause to reproach. We had some bitter enemies in the city who were watching our every movement and were ready to use any unwise action to our injury. It became, therefore, extremely necessary to heed the apostles' admonition to shun every appearance of evil. Dangerous independence. I did not claim that the brother had committed actual sin in his course of action, but I reasoned that our enemies would make capital of what he claimed to be innocent. He took the position that he had a right to do as he pleased in the matter, especially when it was admitted that there was no sin in what he was doing. Thus things went on until January 23, 1872, when I went from Sonoma County to San Francisco to see what could be done to check matters there. By this time, our enemies were making use of his course, as I had feared, and he was taking the position that it was none of their business, that he would show them that he had a mind of his own and could walk the streets as he pleased and with whom he pleased without being subject to their remarks. I tried by private labor to show him that such a course of action would not answer, and that such an independent spirit would end in evil. He had his friends who strongly sympathized with him, some of whom began to take a position which would subject him to still greater censure. A large portion of the church saw the evil of his waywardness and were ready to second the efforts I was making to save the cause from dishonor. Investigation meeting appointed. Thus matters stood on Sabbath, January 27, when it was decided that there must be an investigation of the case and some decisive action taken by the church to save them from the stigma that this defiant spirit was likely to produce. A meeting was appointed to begin Sunday, January 28, at 9 a.m. for the consideration of the situation and our duty as a church in reference to the same. To all appearances, a division of that church was inevitable. I spent much of that night in prayer to God that He would work in our behalf. A written confession. On the morning of the 28th, as I started for the meeting, I met the fellow laborer on the sidewalk near my boarding place, weeping. Said he, "Brother Loughborough, I am not going to the meeting today." "Not going to the meeting," said I. "The meeting relates to your case." "I know that," said he, "but I'm all wrong. You are right in the position that you have taken in reference to me. Here is a letter of confession I have written to the church. You take it and read it to them. It will be better for you and better for those who might be inclined to sympathize with me if I am not there." "Well, what has occasioned this great change in you since yesterday?" I inquired. "A wonderful vision received," he replied. "I went to the post office last night after the Sabbath and received a letter from Sister White from Battle Creek, Michigan. It is a testimony she had written out for me. Handing it to me, he said, 'Read that, and you will see how the Lord sees my case.' He requested me to say to the church that he had received a testimony from Sister White reproving him for his conduct, and that he accepted it as it was the truth." Convincing nature of the vision. This was part of a view given to Mrs. White at Bordeauxville, Vermont, December 10, 1871. She began to write the part relating to this brother's case December 27, 1871, but for some reason the completion of the document was delayed until January 18, 1872, at which time it was finished and mailed from Battle Creek. It then required about 9 days to get letters overland from Michigan to California. In vision, many things are shown her prophetically. It was so in this instance. At the time of the vision, there was but a shadow of what was actually developed when the testimony arrived in San Francisco. It will be seen from a comparison of dates that the culmination of the case in San Francisco came after the written testimony left the former place. Our brethren in San Francisco saw at once that no person could have written to Battle Creek and communicated the intelligence to Mrs. White in time for her to write this letter, for the state of things did not then exist. This fact was of great weight with the brethren there, convincing them that there was divine power with that vision. I had not written a line to Elder White or his wife concerning the state of things in San Francisco, and the fellow laborer declared that he had written nothing, and the brethren said if he had written, he would not have told the things that were brought out concerning himself. How vision was written. When we afterward learned from the other end of the line concerning the writing out and mailing of the testimony, it was still further evident that the Lord who gave the vision had a care over the time of its being written and forwarded to its destination so that it would reach there just at the right time. At a very early hour on the morning of January 18, 1872, Mrs. White was awakened with the above testimony vividly impressed upon her mind. The impression was as distinct to her as though audibly spoken. Write out immediately that testimony for California and get it into the very next mail. It is needed. This being repeated the second time, she arose, hastily dressed, and completed the writing. Just before breakfast, she handed it to her son, Willie, saying, "Take this letter to the post office, but don't stop to put it in the drop. Hand it to the postmaster, and have him be sure to put it in the mailbag that goes out this morning." He afterward said that he thought her instructions a little peculiar, but he asked no questions, and did as he was bidden, and saw the letter go into the mailbag. Proof of divine guidance. Knowing our situation in San Francisco at that time, you will readily see the importance of getting that letter into that very mail. In those days, we had only one overland mail per day. Had the letter come Sunday night, the 28th, instead of Saturday night, the 27th, there would doubtless have been a sad rupture in the church. Had it come several weeks earlier, even just after the vision was given, the church would not so readily have seen its force. Here was a testimony which bore evident marks of the Lord's hand, not only in that it arrived at proper time to effectually correct the existing errors, but being humbly accepted and acted upon by the brother, it exerted a mighty influence to bring unity and stability into that young church. Manner of writing out the visions. This instance serves also as an illustration of her own statement respecting the manner of writing out what she has seen. Of this she says, quote, "I have been aroused from my sleep with a vivid sense of subjects previously presented to my mind, and I have written at midnight letters that have gone across the continent, and arriving at a crisis, have saved a great disaster to the cause." Close quote. Testimonies for the Church, Volume 5, Number 33, page 671. End of chapter 24.